the head of the Faith and Work Initiative at Princeton University. Not the seminary, the university. Drew Cleveland, who many of you know, is at Princeton Seminary, but David's at Princeton University. In addition to that, he teaches in the religion department at Princeton. Through the Avodah Institute, he serves as an ethics advisor to some of the world's largest companies. He is, as he often puts it, bilingual. He comes from both of the two different worlds. He is a former senior executive and also an ordained pastor. So he understands the language and the concerns of both the business world and the ecclesial world from the inside. David has spoken at several of our OM member schools. I remember I heard him speak when he came to the Trinity faculty retreat to speak there, and was blown away by the experience. So with no further ado, will you please help me welcome David Miller?
Thanks. Thank you for the kind words, and good evening, everybody. So I have a suggestion. Could everyone just stand up and like do a little stretch or something and hug your neighbor or whatever works for you, but just to get ready for the next round? Sorry. Tom Nelson, where are you? You hiding back here somewhere? So Tom, the church Karen and I attend, the full Presbyterian church, this would be a more than full Sunday, what we have in this room. But one of the special parts about being in a small church is when you have the greet your neighbor moment, you just can't get everyone back to their seats because everyone's having a good time. So as people come back to their seats, let me jump into the note. Earlier I was talking with Larry Ward. Where are you, Larry? Here we are. And I realized, you may not realize it, but Larry and I are related. We're twin sons of different mothers. My middle name is Ward. There you go. And it is named after a family friend. It's a surname of, so it's nice. It's special to see many old friends, you know who you are, who've been part of my journey for many years in this space. I've been thinking about faith and work. First in my corporate life, when I was on the user side of the equation, if you will, trying to figure out, did my work matter to God? That would be a good title for a book, wouldn't it? And then as an academic, and now in this crazy world, I move in and out of academia and the corporate world and the church world. It's an important question, and I look forward to learning some from you tonight. I'm in the process of revising. I wrote a book called God at Work, which studies this faith at work movement, and I'm doing a revision of it, thanks to support also from our current friends, to say what's changed, what's gone on in this movement over the past 8 or so years since that book came out. And that's a little bit of what we'll cover tonight, or that Greg's asked me to cover. Let me also say something usually I say at the end of a talk. If any of you are even partially interested in what I share tonight, leave me your business card or something afterwards. And in particular, if you disagree with something I've said, or you think I've missed something really big, we'll have a little time for conversation. I'd welcome your thoughts there. But please feel free to email me afterwards and say, you missed the boat on this one, but there's a whole other phenomenon you've missed in your research. I'd really like to know that. And my email address is here at the bottom. It's an eye test, but it's my initials, dwm@princeton.edu. When Greg opened and gave me this nice little admirably brief introduction, which I appreciate, it reminded me, and then you gave me a warm little round of applause. I once gave a talk where I received a standing ovation before I uttered a word. Anyone ever have that happen? So I was all mic'd up like this, and I don't know about you, I get a little bit nervous before I speak in public, so I I decided to slip off to the men's room and do my business, and yeah, you see where this is going. Unlike Kevin here, the sound guy, who turned me off, I was still on. I didn't realize it, so I'm whistling away in the men's room, and came back out. It was a men's retreat, 600 guys on a Saturday. They loved it. So, and I realized what happened. So, anyway, how many of you are theologians in the room? Show of hands. All right, this cartoon's for you. So we think we got it figured out, right? So I once gave an ethics lecture, and technically I'm an ethicist, that's my field. I once gave an ethics lesson using all New Yorker cartoons and all Pepper and Salt cartoons from the Wall Street Journal. And I had more fun doing that. So you'll see a few things interspersed here with that. What is it I've been asked to do? So here are my talking points of what we're going to try to do. First, I want to set a little bit of context of where I live, what my orbit is. Context, we all know that matters, so I'll start with that. And then as Greg and I were planning and scheming on what to do, I'm going to play off of the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future, and hope that, as Tiny Tim said, that God will bless us each and every one by the time we're done. And then if we have time at the end, welcome conversation. But feel free to just raise your hand at any point, or we could have a conversation at the end. But if someone wants to chime in before then, please do. So, yeah, this is where I work. Check this out. Princeton has this sort of understated way of doing things, and it's called the chapel, the University Chapel. I don't know about you, where I grew up, a chapel was sort of like a little thing. It's an extraordinary Gothic cathedral. Princeton was founded by Presbyterians. Like most of the Ivy League schools, they have a religious grounding. You may not know it today as a secular research university, but our university motto still is in Latin, translated into English. It's "Under God's light, she flourishes." Under God's light, she flourishes, and that's not yet been stripped out. So we're kind of pleased that I had the privilege of, believe it or not, that's me preaching. And the hardest part about preaching in this chapel isn't the fact that you're overwhelmed and you feel completely inadequate and undeserving of being there, which of course is the big thing. It's walking up those 15 steps without tripping over your preaching is the real problem. But I preached on vocation, and I preached on calling. And in fact, Bruce and I were having a little conversation earlier about the nature of calling. And I think a lot of folks in at least the seminary world, and some of what I experienced, frankly, when I was going through seminary, was sort of a romanticizing of calling. That it's this lovey-dovey thing, it's sort of narcissistic, and we're all really happy, and people think that it's about aligning our joys with the world. Well, a lot of callings that may align our joys, but it may not. It may be brutal, hard work, and that's really the essence of a biblical narrative, and that's what I preached about. And one person who was in the congregation that day then asked for a copy of the sermon. He said, "I need to send this to all of my grandchildren." And I'm not saying that because I'm a great preacher, because I'm not, but he got the message that work matters, work can be a calling. Because my whole focus was that paid work and for-profit institutions can be God's work, it can be holy work. So this is John Witherspoon. You might remember him. He was a Presbyterian pastor, a president of Princeton University, and a professor, and also a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was the only clergy person who signed that, which essentially was like signing your death warrant, if you think about it, going publicly that you agree to this proposition. Now, students being students, good old John has different attire at different times of the year, and sometimes you might even see a 12-ounce vessel in his hand that someone might put there. So this is my current world. The Faith and Work Initiative, we were founded in 2008, and our mission is very simple. We're trying to develop theoretical and academic insights into this intersection of faith and work, and then out of that to develop practical resources. I have a specific focus on leaders and leadership. And that's not to say that the non-leadership world is unimportant, but my view, and in some ways it reflects my background, is that if leaders change, then organizations change a lot quicker than through a grassroots bottom-up. So that's my focus on leadership. Also importantly, as I mentioned, I am at a secular research university, and it probably would not have flown at all for me to do a Christian center. So the center looks at the three Abrahamic traditions and asks, what does Islam, Judaism, and Christianity have to say about the marketplace and this vector. And of course that reflects the reality of the world we live in, doesn't it? So in some ways it's hugely stimulating, myself as a Christian, as a follower of Christ, to be operating in this context, because my ideas have to work. They have to matter, and the research we do has to matter. It has to pass the sniff test, because I'm not preaching to the choir. So that's a very stimulating thing. And I also had a chance through some of my work to spend a lot of time doing advisory and consulting work with secular companies, as Greg was briefly mentioning. So I work with the CEO and the C-suite teams of lots of big companies like Citibank, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, BP, helping them think through straight questions of ethics and ethical culture. But the darndest thing is, I'm usually brought in as a sort of an ethicist to do that in a formal way, and my prior background as being a former executive, that I sort of know that language in that world. The darndest thing is, over dinner, inevitably, someone will say, perhaps it's after a glass of wine, they might say, well, you do this God stuff, don't you? Yeah. Because I've Googled you. Yeah, I understand. And then before you know it, you're spending the rest of the evening talking about faith. I was saying to Gregory, they'll say, so this Jesus guy, do you really believe that stuff? Yeah. And then you have a conversation about it. So it's extraordinary how the marketplace, in addition to the intrinsic value of work, both the work itself and its telos, its purpose, its aim, is hugely important. It's also a venue, an extraordinary venue, to ask what Bill Pollard used to call the question of God. These are my students. If they're not looking happy, it's because they're taking a midterm. Just a brief aside in the story. Again, I'm test driving a lot of my ideas in the laboratory of the academy. A little bit, Tom Nelson and I were having this conversation. Then I take them out into the real world and test drive them with Citibank or other companies and find out, will this dog hunt, or have I missed something, or can I tweak it? So this class, Business Ethics and Modern Religious Thought, the students jokingly call it How to Succeed Without Selling Your Soul. But I ask the question, what does Judaism, what does Christianity, and what does Islam have to do with ethics, the modern marketplace, and leadership? Well, the answer is, everyone in this room would easily know, is a lot. We just unfortunately don't hear it a lot from the pulpits. So this is what we've talked about for 24 contact hours, then another 12 hours with precept hours with our teaching fellows. I bring in executives, senior executives, CEOs from these different faith traditions, so students can have role models of someone who's been outrageously successful by worldly measures in a corporate career, and yet still hold dear to their foundation, their North Star, their faith as a legitimate intellectual resource and a practical resource. So in many ways, my proposition is trying to intellectually validate the kind of questions that ON talks about and what this movement, Faith at Work movement, talks about. By the way, the students, they're all over the map in their faith journey. They are. I have every tradition you can imagine there, including atheists and agnostics. This year in particular, my best student was an atheist who is clearly wrestling with the faith question, which he had never, ever had to do before. Extraordinary. And I don't want to, I'm not a betting man, but I'd make a small wager that if we were to fast forward and track him in his life, at some point he's going to cross over the line, and he's going to realize that faith is something he should bring into his life. Well, the students are great. I learn an immense amount from them. So I want to position this also as part of the context that it's a piece of my research. I touch on it briefly in the latter part of the God at Work book. It's called, we used to call it the integration box, and now we're calling it the integration profile with a P. So it's now called TIP, T-I-P. And the TIP essentially, how many of you have taken Myers-Briggs tests? Of course, everybody has, success finders, all these psychometric scales. Essentially, it developed out of an observation when I was tracking the Faith at Work movement. I was trying to figure out, well, how do we understand this movement? And I'm sort of a Niebuhrian, Weberian, Trollchian kind of scholar, so I'm interested in typologies, and how we kind of map this group out. What's it look like? And initially I thought, well, there's liberals and conservatives, progressives and orthodox. All those labels seem to fail. It's much more multidimensional than just a sort of a dialectical way of thinking about it. And I came to conclude there are four different attributes, four different ways that people manifest their faith at work, however subconscious that might be. And like Myers-Briggs, I also came to first theorize and then later validate empirically through social scientific methods, but that most people have a natural predisposition to one of these four ways. And for some people, might be two, for some three, but most people have a natural predisposition. And that could be because of where they were raised, the church they're in, or just their internal wiring, just like Myers-Briggs. You're an introvert or an extrovert. You didn't choose it. It's just how you are. Briefly, let me tell you what the four are, these four different types are, because later then I'm using that as the filter now to analyze the faith and work movement and to try to get a sense of how do these organizations, such as Kern, such as the New Canaan Society or whatever group we might think of, how do they fit into these different ways? So first, one of the typical ways people think about integrating faith and work is ethics. So the Bible is all about think of the great prophets and fair weights and measures and scales and being a person of your word. So honesty, truth in dealing. So being ethical, or today we might use the language of justice or social justice. And each of these have two subcategories. So there's your personal ethics. Do I cheat on my expense accounts? Am I sleeping with my secretaries? There's personal probity. But then there's the ethics of your organization, the products and goods and services you create. What are you doing for the greater society? Is it a noble and good work, or is it something that is not God-pleasing? So there's ethics at a community level, an organizational level, as well as your individual self. Experience is another one that many people quickly resonate with. For me, I had to get these all to start with an E, so I had to stretch on experience. Experience is how do you experience your work? Is it just a job to pay the rent, which is actually fine in its own right, or is it a calling? Is there a certain nobility? Is there a vocatio, a vocation, something bigger? Has God called you to the work, this work? Can you connect and find a spiritual dimension to your work? And for many people, they can. And let me make really clear, that's just not people like all of us in this room who do knowledge work. It's also very much the same if you're a blue-collar worker, if you're doing hourly work. That is just as noble, just as dignified. And you can tell when someone is really engaged in their work versus someone who's just going through the motions. So experience, and here, is it the work itself, the activity you're doing? Are you a master craftsman? Is that what your expertise is? Or is it the output of your product? I do a lot of work with Tyson Foods. Some of you may know that one in four meals that you buy with protein in it has been made by Tyson Foods in the United States. They've done a lot of innovative things in this category of faith and work. I might touch on some of it later. And to be sure, they also have a ton of problems, and they're the first to admit it. Everyone sues them for just about everything you can think of, and sometimes rightly and sometimes not rightly. But they don't, if you're working on a kill line in the poultry plant, their employees have come to realize they're not just plucking chicken or killing chicken, they're feeding the world in a healthy way. I mean, these are whole different ways of framing work. So is your work a vocation, a calling, meaning, purpose? That's experience. The third is enrichment. That's a little bit sometimes harder. That's the sort of the balm in Gilead. That's the tending to the inner soul. But work can be brutal and tough. Someone steals your work. They take credit for your work. You get fired for not you're laid off, not because you did something wrong, because the jobs are all going over to Pakistan or somewhere else. And that's the person who gets up early and does a Bible study or a devotional or a meditation, something to stay spiritually grounded. They may do it as a solo activity or in a group. And the fourth one, and I saved it for last, is often what people first think of. Initially, in the evolution of this model, I called it evangelism. But I wanted this model to work for every religious tradition, the model to work for every religious tradition. And obviously, take Judaism, it's not an evangelizing tradition. So I came up with the word expression. So for many people, the way they manifest their faith at work is not through ethics, experience, or enrichment, but it's very important that they express their faith at work, whether it's out of religious obligation or duty or choice or design, and for some it's verbal, and for some it's nonverbal. So those are the two different categories there. So this is the filter, the lens, that now I look at every group. That's always the way I'm analyzing it to try to figure out where's the natural gravity of this group. And of course, some groups are in multiple areas and some just in one. But it's a helpful handhold. And Tim Keller and Catherine O'Leary up at Redeemer Press in New York, they've sort of incorporated this model in a lot of the rollout they're doing through their Faith and Work Center as a way of filtering and thinking about it. And they're trying to be attentive to making sure they touch all four of these in their work, because they're all four biblically valid, theologically valid. And too often, we just sort of default into thinking, well, this is the only mode, and when indeed there's more. So I just wanted to take a minute on that. We'll come back to that in this four E's or tip, and I'm in the process of developing a psychometric scale or where you actually could go online in software where you could actually take it and you'll kick out the report and you'll find out, oh, I'm an ethics type, or oh, I'm an experience type, so you have greater self-awareness. Some clergy are using this tool in their churches. And we had a dean in a pastor getting to in his DMIN that he used this model as a way to evaluate his church. Where were they all sitting? And then, and was he tending to all four of their needs of how their faith manifests itself at work? And as a result, he's changed his preaching, his pastoral prayers, and his adult education as a result. So, yeah, this religion at work, the vocabulary matters. Is it faith at work, spirituality at work, religion at work? A lot of different ways to think about it. That's the New York Stock Exchange. I go to an event there called the CEO Summit, and I'm brought there specifically, get this, it's all corporate titans and CEOs of names we would all know, and the main reason the professor who runs this thing is the leadership guru up at Yale School of Management, is he wants a spiritual voice there. Stunning. He wants a spiritual voice. And he asked me always to give an interpretive lens and to challenge some of the operative assumptions that are in the room. So there's surprising interest in this field. It's a new world. It's a new world. We live in a post-Christian world. This is in London Heathrow, Terminal 4. But you'll find the same thing if you are in Dallas or if you are in Minneapolis Airport. So now let's jump into these three different things. It goes through Christmas past, present, and future. I just want to take a few moments on the past. The design of the book is I realized that there are these different waves or eras that went on in the Faith at Work movement. I started it back in the late 1800s with Pope Leo and his encyclical Rerum Novarum, and then the social gospel movement quickly followed on that's heels. And that was one wave of the movement. The second wave happened after World War II, where there was this great optimism and belief in the human ability and the human capacity, and the ministry of the laity movement started. It aligned off also nicely with the Vatican II changes, but also very much in the Protestant Church. The Bose Institute was founded over in Switzerland. But then I noticed that movement had a little incurvumse. It turned in on itself, and it became all about the Sunday and not about Monday. And that movement then ran out of gas, the ministry of the laity. And many in this room were probably part of that. I remember there was a whole lot of literature in the 50s and 60s on this area. I remember one church I attended, it was a big Presbyterian church, and they did a survey of all the members of the church, what their gifts were and their alignments, to figure out what their lay ministry was going to be. And I was so excited, and I said, yes, my church is getting it, this is wonderful. And then they had the big announcement of what it was going to do, and they said, well, this is great. With these skills, we need more people in the greeting committee, more Sunday school teachers, more greeters. No, it's about Monday, not Sunday. And they hadn't got it. They hadn't got it. So that movement has fallen apart. And now we're in wave three that I call the Faith at Work movement. And it's driven by integration, a desire for meaning and purpose, where people want to bring their whole selves to work. And it's not just faith. It's other things as well. As John Tyson is fond of saying, if you think here in California, in Silicon Valley environment, where kind of anything goes to work, John is fond of saying, if you could bring your dog to work, why can't you bring your faith to work? Each wave has had some inner tensions and a reason they've receded. So the question is, where are we in this wave three? I peg it as starting about the time the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and also about the same time the Soviet Union was falling. And AT&T in the U.S. Had its first major, big first corporate white-collar worker layoff, and about 45,000 people were laid off. And that sort of jolted and changed a lot of things. It was a seismic time. So here are, as we think of the first part of this Faith at Work movement, from 89 to 2007, here are some attributes that describe it. And we won't go through each of these. But there is a sociologist have a criteria of what constitutes a social movement. Bob Wuthnow is my mentor, and I work with him at Princeton University, the sociologist of religion. He asked me one of those irritatingly simple but good questions I couldn't answer. And he said, how do you know it's a movement? Maybe it's just a flash in the pan. It's this year's Pet Rocks. I said, oh. So then I had to analyze what constitutes a movement, and it turns out there's three different criteria, and does this mean that? And the good news, Josh, is it does. So we're still in business. This is a bit, what we in this room and others like us are in quest of has not run out of gas from a demand point of view, because there's the supply and demand side of the equation. From the demand point of view of laity, of men and women who are trying to connect the dots between their Sunday and their Monday. It's largely been lay-led and lay-founded. It's not been led by the academy, by and large. It's not been led by the church, by and large. And even in this time window, most, with obviously the exception of people in this room and your institutions, Most, if anything, there's a benign neglect ranging even to a certain antipathy towards the marketplace and the economic sphere. It's all about integration, holistic. You can see these other attributes that happen in this part of the wave up until 2007. My book came out in 2007, which is why I'm using that as a demarcation. So what's been going on in the past, and by the way, that Fortune article in Fortune magazine, that was an extraordinary event when that happened. When that article came out, Mark Gunther is at the time was a secular Jew and now is a believing Jew. He interviewed me and several other people for that article, and he told me that that article almost got cut the week before because it was seen as so controversial within the editorial staff. That what are we doing talking about this God stuff? You know, we're a business magazine, for heaven's sakes. He told me, though, the only reason the story got out is because it was a slow news week, and it didn't get caught because of something else. And I said, well, how did it do? And he said, it had an overwhelmingly positive reaction, only a handful of people writing emails and saying, this is rubbish, what are we doing this for? And not only that, he said it was the best-selling issue of Fortune magazine in its history, as measured by newsstand sales. Extraordinary. Because people want to do this. No, by the way, it's not just Christians. Jews are interested in this, Buddhists are interested in this, you name it, people, humans are interested in this question. So, yeah, what's changed since 2007 and where we are now? That's what I've been spending an awful lot of my time working, and Drew's been a good help on our research team. I've got a postdoc helping me with this project as well, a couple postdocs, and we're doing a lot of work. And you can see already the change here. There's this New Agey look to Diversity Inc. magazine and religion in the workplace. So, and now I want to look at what's the same and what's changed. So first, some context. You probably all know this information, but this is some data that's helpful to remember. We don't live in Kansas anymore, Toto. We're not there. But look at those numbers. In the back, you can't read it. Christianity, according to this the CIA World Factbook in 2010, has changed a little bit. It's about 33% of the world's population. Islam, about 23%. The next biggest is Hindu, Buddhist. Others, a big category. Judaism, about 0.2%. Non-religious and atheists. Let's bring the helicopter a little bit closer to home. U.S. So we see 74% is Christians, so the Protestant Catholic split there. And then Mormons, interesting that they were broken out separately. 1.7, Jewish, 1.7. Islam, or Muslim, 0.6. And by the way, it's estimated that number already might have increased to being about 1%, about 3.3 million Muslims in America. And that's driven largely by immigration patterns. But that's the world we live in and preach in and teach in. We do not live in a bubble anymore. That's my classroom. So there's, of course, the spiritual but not religious crowd you're all aware of, and the so-called nuns. By the way, some of you may have followed Bob Putnam's research. In his most recent book, I think it's called In Poles We Trust. It's a very insightful book, and if you don't want to read the whole book, he wrote an essay in an article in First Things that essentially summarizes the book. And what he's largely arguing is that we can't trust polls anymore. So when we read, we're all quoting Pew data now and whatever, Quinnipiac survey, but of course the religion ones largely come out of Pew, that they're totally unreliable. About the only thing he said they're good for is the population on which they've actually surveyed. But we cannot make generalizable assumptions about it. Two main reasons for that. Let's do a quick little informal survey here, speaking of polls, a little survey. When was the last time any one of you in this room answered a survey pollster when they called you during dinner? No hands went up. That's one problem. So who is answering that phone call? It's not representative of society. The second is that most of us now, many people, we live and die by our cell phones. Many people are even getting rid of their landlines right now. And the pollsters can no longer tell what your zip code is based on what your phone number is. So that's why they're wildly, incorrectly predicting elections and missing like the last big election in the UK and many of the things that are going on in the US. So one of the WIPNOS points is surveys are very helpful, but most of them are not done. They're just simple polls, and the response rates, here's the other killer, the response rates are often in single digits. They used to be like 60, 70% was considered best practice. Today they're 8, 9% of a population which is not representative. So when I say it because the nuns, and there's all this alarming data, no one's going to church anymore, and America's becoming less religious. Bob Whitno, who does not have an axe to grind, he doesn't have a sort of a money in the fight, he said that he doesn't have confidence in that data, that he thinks the patterns are still pretty much the same as they've been. During college, people sort of slip away from their faith, and as they get married, they go back to their faith, and as they have kids, they go back to their faith. But that's just sort of a time and true pattern. So here's a contextual issue that I'm also dealing with. So there's no moral compass at that I saw on the streets of San Francisco. I noticed in my students, and they're some of the best and brightest in the world, and gosh, they're good kids, and they have great hearts and big values, and they want to do the right thing. But I also noticed that most of them are ethical relativists, or moral relativists. The idea of having some deontological or content principles, where some things are always right and some things are always wrong, they don't like that. They don't buy it. So it's a very different environment. And that's the people then that Citibank and everybody else is hiring to come work for them. That there's this relativity. One of the big challenges is it not that they're bad kids or that they want to do evil, if anything, the opposite, they want to do good. But they often don't have the moral vocabulary, the spiritual or ethical vocabulary to do that and negotiate that. I'm trying to bring that to them as religion, as one of the tools to help them do that, which many of you are doing in your own ways as well. But that's the context in which we're talking about faith and work and the economy. So, in fact, some of the biggest interest I get in this question is not from religious institutions. It's not from religious institutions. So Harvard B School, your alma mater there, Will, they invited me up. You'll remember their advanced management program. AMP is their elite program for executives from around the world who will come in for a 10-week residential program. And I was one of their guest lecturers they brought in. They specifically wanted me to talk about this question of faith and work. And I kept, this was the title of my talk, are they opposing forces or are they in fact convergent or complementary resources? And you could have heard a pin drop. They were so excited and so interested. And all they needed was just a tiny bit of intellectual permission to talk about the subject. And they just went loose. They were totally into it. The irony of the whole thing is I was asked to give the talk on the evening of Yom Kippur started. And I called up Harvard and said, there might be a little problem. Because I knew there was an Israeli designation. And I'm sure others would have been Jewish as well. And I said, maybe we should schedule it at a different time, or at least before sundown. And their answer, oh, no one's going to matter. I don't care. Oh, really? They did. And there are a couple who were really ticked off that that's when the lecture was given. I said, I wouldn't like to do that, but are you? Anyway, the B-School world and the academic academy, the Academy of Management, are all over this faith and work question. They put, how many of you are members of AAR? I'm sure many of you. Or then the various sister organizations, SBL and so forth. Those organizations pay scant attention to the economy, and when they do, it's probably a very outcome-predictable critique of the evils and horrors of the capitalist proposition. Whereas, and seldom any sort of constructive theological inquiry as to the redemptive possibilities of the business world, even in its fallen state, for what it can do for the world. The Business Academy, Academy of Management, I'm a member of both guilds, is all over this question. They have a special interest group called Management, Spirituality, and Religion, which now has about 700 members and writing papers. And many of them are not written by people who are believers. They're just looking at it as a utilitarian academic exercise. They're studying it just like they study other things. But many people are also deep in abiding faith, and they're trying to connect the dots. So, this is what I'm in the middle of. This God at Work 2 is what we're calling it in-house. And I pose the question, is it still a movement or is it receding? What's different? It's the same. And we've studied over 450 entities in some detail. And I'll give you a little bit of what we've learned from those 450 entities. Now, by entities, I mean what I would call faith at work groups. So these are organizations, many of you will know, just as yourselves, that are focused on and dedicated to doing something with faith and work. They're often lay-led, they're lay-founded. Some are just in one city, and that's all they tend to, like Needle's Eye Ministry in Charlotte. Others are national organizations, like the New Canaan Society, and some are international organizations, There's old ones that have been around forever, like the Foursquare Gospel Movement, the Gideons, the Christian Businessmen's Association. There's a few like that, but there are many new innovative ones. Some ebb and flow. When the leader moves on, or the founder, or the finances change, they wrap up and go away. And others have been around for decades. Some have a budget, they're sort of, as the Brits would say, with just sort of a man and a dog. And others have multi-million dollar budgets and are doing extraordinary things with extraordinary resources. So that's what we've been studying, to say, well, what is going on? Some of them are groups that meet at companies. So Citibank, American Express, HP, many companies have different, Ford Motor Company, have different fellowship groups. They would call them affinity groups, just like there might be an LGBT group, or there might be an African-American group, or a women's group, or an Asian group. There are now many faith groups with official sanction at companies. Ford calls it FIN. They have a sort of an overarching thing called Ford Interfaith Network, and then within that there's a Christian group, a Jewish group, a Muslim group, and so on. Deloitte, that I do, also do some consulting work. They have the same thing. They have a Christian group, a Sikh group, a Muslim group, a whole bunch of different groups with official sanctioning budget that they could use corporate resources to talk about issues of faith that work. Some people are beginning to argue that a lot of the diversity, the D&I, diversity and inclusion movement, it causes more dissension than cohesion, that everyone's focusing on their particularity and missing the unifying part of God's very diverse universe. And some have argued that the faith at work movement is perhaps one of the few unifying things in companies. Because regardless what God you believe in or worship, not to get into the Wheaton controversy right now, but if you believe in God, whoever your God is, or as AA would say, sort of a higher power, whatever it is, that is a common thread. That some of the most interesting conversations I've had with people of other religious traditions are those people who really, really believe what they believe. And just like I believe what I believe, and to have an intense conversation. So done the right way, it's a unifying force. So those are things within companies. But others are groups that meet in coffee shops. I'm part of a group called the CEO Forum, and it meets at very elite, high-end, four-star restaurants. So it's all over the map, the way that these groups gather. Some are gathered by industry sectors, some by organizational level or type or affinity, and others are just sort of small groups, that just people getting together to help each other solve problems. So this tip and the four E's is the lens through which we looked at those. We'll come back to them in a minute. So, what's the same, first of all, for the faith and work movement now, the world that you and I are operating in right now? So it still meets the criteria of being a social movement, so it still is very much alive. And in fact, our research suggests the movement is growing. There's well over 1,000 organizations in the U.S. that are focused on faith and work. We studied 450 of them in this current research. We're still largely lay-led and lay-founded by a man or a woman who often feels the church has let them down, frankly. And that they are therefore being good entrepreneurs, being good Mr. Kearns, if you will. They're starting their own thing. They're figuring out, well, if someone else isn't going to solve it, I will solve it. In the earlier days of the movement, it took a lot of ingenuity. Today, because of the internet and technology, the startup costs are very low, and it's the amount of resources that are out there today is almost an embarrassing amount of resources. And of course, Will, your group and Workplace Theology of Work Project is doing so much to help that and making these things available for free that weren't there even a decade ago, let alone, say, 30 or 40 years ago. Organizing principle is still about integration, wanting to bring your whole self to work, and it's still also about meaning and purpose. These FAW, that's my abbreviation for faith at work groups or entities, whatever you want to call them, they meet in and outside the office. Generational differences, there always have been, but I'll talk in a minute, they're becoming more observable and with a greater impact on the movement. So as you all, as leaders and participants in the movement, are thinking about it, I want to come back to the generational in a moment. And my early research showed, and still continues, that the range of faith traditions in and outside of Christianity, and my research focused mostly on Christianity, the Christian part of this movement, but there's a wide diversity within it, as we might imagine. There's the Anglican Communion, there's progressive Protestants, there's conservatives, there's Orthodox with a small O and a capital O, there's Catholics, there's Protestants. There's a lot of diversity, more in the movement than often is represented in certain organizations and gatherings. And the demographics are also very interesting. We'll come into some of that is changing and some of that is the same. Some people critique the movement saying it's just for rich white people. And there certainly is an element of that, that a lot of the gatherings that happen, where they meet and what they do, are for affluent people. But there's also increasing attention to the movement that, well, that's obviously not all of God's kingdom. And there's a lot of activity beginning to go on in more diverse, both socioeconomic, racial, and ethnic activity. But I want to come to that in a moment. And these different, as I say, manifest itself. So faith at work can manifest itself in many ways. And some people aren't part of groups, but they're profoundly driven by this question. So if that's some things that are the same, let me do my clicker clicking here. What's changed or new? So I mentioned this group, we'll come and talk a bit about them. Let's just do it now. So if you run them through the TIP, through the integration profile on the four E's, so that's, what were they again? Experience, ethics, enrichment, and expression. And each have their two sub-orientations. And you can imagine the spreadsheet, but we evaluated each one of these four groups based on publicly available information. In some cases, I have further knowledge because I've been at this for a few years. We evaluated them to see we evaluated them on four different levels, or three of them, strong, moderate, or weak for each group, according to each of the four E's. And here's what, what do you think of the four E's do you think would have had the strongest rating? By that I mean it's an accent of that organization, that faith at work group, that their accent is one of the four E's. Perhaps totally subconscious, of course. They don't know my model, my lens. So of expression, ethics, enriching, you're guessing expression. That was my guess too. Any other guesses? Ethics?
Enrichment.
Interesting. Okay, so a bit of a spread. I would not have guessed enrichment, actually. But that's interesting to say that. So here's 43% of the groups got a strong rating for ethics. Next, 39% got a strong for enrichment, which surprised me, which also reminded me of how many hurting people there are in the marketplace. How many hurting people. The work marketplace can be brutal sometimes. It can spit you up and chew you out, as you well know, or your parishioners or your students have told you. 35% were rated strong in expression. That's the one I thought would have had more oomph, more gravity, that would have been stronger for more of them. And experience, vocation, calling, meaning, that one, I was surprised that was quote-unquote as low as. Now, having said that, that's, again, just how we rated them, strong, moderate, or weak. But here is the interesting thing. No group out of 450 got a strong rating in all four categories. None. Now, I hypothesized, in fact, my wife is my greatest critic and supporter. She helped edit the first version of God at Work, and I remember I have a sentence in it, and she said, you can't do that, that sounds very arrogant, but I did it anyway. And the sentence was, I made a prescriptive move, because I'm trying to be this neutral scholar, right, and have dispassionate reason and all the stuff you have to do in a secular research university and Oxford Press and all that stuff. But I made a prescriptive move, and I said that the mature Christian life ought to be attentive to all four of these areas, because they're all biblically sound and theologically valid. So the mature Christian life, even though we might have a natural predisposition, we ought to learn to go in the spaces we're not comfortable with, and also to understand our neighbor, who maybe that's their voice. But no one of these groups rated strong in all four. But here's the other interesting thing. The language of experience was the most present. It was the most present. Maybe not strong in all, in a higher percentage, but it was the present. Everyone is talking about meaning, purpose. Why do I go to work in addition to making the money? And we're just beginning to tease this data out. I have sort of 100 different questions going through my mind in my postdocs or working on it. And in fact, if any of you have questions, what would you like to know about the nature of this movement, its attributes and characteristics, shoot me a question, shoot me an email. And I may not be able to answer it, but it'll help me put that into the filter of questions we're asking. Because if we think of ourselves as builders and designers, and all of you are entrepreneurs in your own way, being part of this network and the things you're doing in your teaching institutions, we're trying to move the needle, trying to change things. So having data on which to make our decisions is often very helpful. So what are some other things that have changed? You remember Cyndi Lauper's song, Money Changes Everything? Well, maybe you don't. But Millennials Changes Everything, and pardon my grammar. It's just a different ballgame. It's a different ballgame. One of the case studies that I used, and it's based on a real life situation at one of the banks I do some advisory work, they had analysts, so it was an entry level job in investment banking, and they had analysts. It's common practice that if you work past 7 p.m., your company usually gives you some meal per diem. And in this case, they got $25. And there's a little software system, you order that, and the company, a local restaurant, comes and delivers your food. So that's a little benefit that these young workers get as their analysts. Well, it turns out a couple of enterprising young analysts figured out how to game the system. And if one of their buddies wasn't at work that day, they would borrow their password and they would order an extra hamburger, or if some, they even had people who were former employees would quit and left, that they still had their, so they could order, like now, for three people just for themselves to get $50 or $75 worth of stuff. Some people got really frisky, so this got reported, and of course management came in, and obviously you're stealing, right? That's theft. You're breaking one of the Ten Commandments, and in banks it's not a good idea to steal money. So of course the natural reaction would be that everyone should have been fired. Well, they did their forensic review, and it turns out that it's more than one or two people is not isolated. We had 600 analysts, over 200 were doing this. Over 200. These are all millennials, right? They're really smart. They're in good jobs, already making a lot of money, so we can't have a pity party for them. They can't make their budget. And they're all gaming the system. Astounding. So what do you do? Do you fire 200 people? Well, now you have a little utilitarian problem. You can't do your work. You just fire your whole workforce, or two-thirds of them, one-third of them. So in the end, they decided, well, they would put a letter in everybody's file and make the, and sort of slap their wrist and say, no, you shouldn't do that. That's against company policy. We don't think stealing is a good idea if you work for a bank. And oh, by the way, they could tell who did what, and we want you to pay back however much there was over your limit. Now, if that had been me as a former banker, if I think back to that stage in my career, I would have been appalled. I would have been ashamed. I would have been mortified. If my parents ever found, I would have just been totally ashamed if I had been caught doing it. The reaction of this group, guess what? They were indignant. Who the hell are you to do to charge? I am working my butt off for you, and I'm just, hey, everyone else is doing it, so what's the big deal? And oh, by the way, I have to work for Google right across the street, or Morgan Stanley, or some other bank, and not only are they going to give me free dinner, they're going to give me free breakfast and lunch as well, and do my dry cleaning too. And you're being such a bunch of cheapskates. Extraordinary. Total ethical relativism. So I figured, okay, that's just people who have gotten sucked into the Wall Street vortex, my former wonderful life. And so I asked my students, who are still bright and innocent, and I use a survey device, so everyone on their laptops and their phones can answer quick survey questions that I give them live in class. And so I figured, well, of course, you know, they're all going to think it's a bad idea. 19% of my students said that they didn't have a problem, they couldn't see what the big deal was. 19%. So these are the people that are going to be flying our planes, managing our pension funds, taking you into surgery. So I'm a little unnerved by this. So, and they're the people you're teaching. And their concept of what constitutes cheating is totally different as well than what it used to be. So, but they're going to ask different things of the faith at work movement than I asked. So I'm a baby boomer, and the tail end of the baby boom generation. They're asking different questions. So we as teachers, as educators, and activists, if you will, the various roles we play in the faith at work movement, we need to make sure we're asking the right questions. It's more than just the old questions. And I think this lens of the four E's is a helpful way to tease and get at what's on their minds. Because the good news is they really care about the world. I mean, there's a lot of inconsistencies. I didn't really care about the world when I was there. I just wanted to get ahead in my career and make a good buck. But no, they're really caring about the world. And it's not just lip service. They want to work for companies whose values they respect, whose products they believe in. It's very hard to get a young chemical engineer to go work for a fossil fuel company today. Because they're seen as the bad guys, however unfair or fair that critique might be. So millennials, I think that's a lens. The second that's changed since the first version of the book is what I'm calling the exogenous influences, and that's just because we're all academics and we have to show off and use big words, but it's things that don't originate from inside the movement. So from the men and women who are yearning for this help to connect their faith to their work and yearning to connect the sermons, as Mark Roberts just so beautifully, and messages from the Bible that are yearning to have that help on Sunday, Now we're getting data and things are being forced upon the movement from the outside. So first of all, the Supreme Court decisions of the United States, a couple big ones, of course there's Hobby Lobby, that's changed a whole bunch of things and legislative impacts. The Abercrombie and Fitch, did you follow that story? Yeah, Abercrombie and Fitch, that was where the young Muslim woman in Tulsa went to work for Abercrombie and Fitch, and she had a scarf on, and they said you can't do that. She said, hey, I'll even put the company logo on it, and company colors. And they said, no, you can't do that. And they said a couple ill-advised things from a manager who didn't really understand some of the legal obligations under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is the main law, which guides religion in the workplace issues. It's not freedom of speech, as many people think, or separation of church and state. So she won her suit, and things are changing. You may have just read Cargill, full disclosure, I do advisory work, and I'm good friends with their CEO. They just fired in Minnesota, one of their meatpacking plants, about 150 Muslims who walked out because in support of a small group of Muslims on one ship who were told that they couldn't all leave at the same time for a prayer break. Which, that's a whole complex thing, because in fact, my read of the facts, and I have some inside information, is that Cargill was fully within their rights, and actually Cargill do try to be supportive of Muslim prayer needs, but one group was breaking the policy, and they were punished for it. And they refused to change their behavior, and then everyone got all worked up about it. So that's forcing some of the terms in the movement now, what the Supreme Court is deciding, and what are coming out of the law courts and the lawyers and legislation. That's changing. In the past, this faith at work movement kind of could go sub terra, could sort of cruise underground. No one really knew what's going on. It's fine as long as anyone didn't get in any trouble or do anything offensive or stupid. Well, now it's in the public domain, and it's under more scrutiny. Immigration patterns are certainly changing things with the large Muslim population coming in from many countries, and accommodation requests. You know, the issues in the old days, and I say a shift in EEOC claims, if you go back, say, 25 years ago, most EEOC claims, and they're the agency which adjudicate religion, the workplace disputes, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the old ones used to be the manager who was forcing one of his employees to come to a prayer breakfast, or who was doing religious harassment in the workplace, or quid pro quo, come to my church and I'll promote you. So there were those were the category of religious discrimination claims. They've almost all gone away. That's really not the issue right now. Most of the claims now are about discrimination and harassment and accommodation. And it's usually a person of a minority religion who is not feeling that they're not being respected or treated fairly by the majority religion, i.e. the Christians. And many of the claims are spurious and they're dismissed, but a lot of the activity right now is in accommodation issues. So here's how everything has changed. As a former investment banker and a partner in a bank over in London, I still think in business vocabulary based on how tired I am or theological categories. So shifting back into my business voices, there's more consumer choices than there used to be today. I mean, think about all of you in church on Sunday. What are you competing with now? Soccer. You're competing with sports, traveling teams. There's 100 new options out there. Well, the faith at work movement as such is also competing for new things. There's alternative ways. This rise of the conscious capitalism movement. So folks that are spiritual but not religious are being drawn into the conscious capitalism movement, which is, in some ways, talking about meaning and doing good in the world. Maybe it focuses on the ethics side of our four E's. Or we've got the mindfulness movement that Apple and many companies now hire Zen Buddhist teachers, and they run courses, and they'll underwrite your yoga courses or a TM course or something like that. They'll underwrite your gym membership. Now, will they underwrite a Christian fellowship group? Probably not. But the mindfulness movement has a lot of analogs to our enrichment category of the four E's. It's secular ways of thinking about prayer and discipline and spiritual nurture. So people have choices now. People have choices. But you might find a person going to church and never think of connecting Sunday to Monday through their Christian lens, but they can go ooh and ah and tell you everything about their mindfulness course they just took at work. I mean, you'll see this in California, right? It's extraordinary. There's more choices. There's more choices. And the obvious thing, of course, is the social media, the digital technology explosion. There's really no barrier to entry now. You could essentially have $30 and buy a website address, and you're up and running. or a free blog site, and you're up and running. So the way, the sort of competition, the options, and I use the word competition intentionally. I don't necessarily mean to take market share away from someone else, but there's a lot of opportunities out there. There's a lot of offerings that are out there that someone might avail themselves of. And also, we know Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. I'm sure many of you read that from Harvard, the sociologist, sort of the society that we don't have bowling leagues anymore, or bridge clubs, or things like that, that we're isolated. We're at home. It's us and our computer. So there's a lot of virtual communities, and what I intentionally am mangling the language to call it a solo group. So groups of one, solo faith and work groups, where someone may not be going to a particular meeting or organization like they might have in the past, but they still are getting fed because of the different communities they might be on online and different ways they could feed. And I think we see the same thing in the church, too, where I know a lot of people who don't go to church, but they'll tell you, I love watching different shows on TV, and that's how I get fed, or things on the internet. Here's this next one concerns me a little bit, this one here, politicization of parts of the faith that we're in. I want to say parts of. There are a couple groups and organizations, some of you may have seen them, been part of them, or observed them, that are doing something that didn't go on in the Faith at Work movement in the earlier part of Wave 3. They're spending a lot of time on culture war issues. And they're politicizing what had been about how do I find meaning in my work and purpose in my work? How do I express myself at work? All these queries. And now they're talking and making jokes or gay bashing. And regardless of what you think of the whole LGBT world and gay marriage, forget whatever your opinion is, we can all respect each other in that, but there's some nastiness going on, and that just used to not be in some of the groups of people making snickering jokes and everybody laughing, and I find that disheartening. So I think we want to be a little careful for those of you who are active in the movement that it doesn't become a spillover of one's political views. It's important to have those political views and our theological views, but there are a couple places, events I've been to, which surprised me at some unpleasant edginess that was going on in the group. And almost a sense that if you're a real Christian, you had to pass a certain litmus test to be part of the Faith at Work group. And when I was first studying the Faith at Work movement, these meetings were marvelous of different Faith at Work groups. You could have a progressive and a conservative at the same table, and they were just getting on fabulously and praying together and celebrating Christ, each with their own theological and biblical orientations. And they didn't get into all the culture war stuff. They focused on this common denominator of the joy and pain and hope and disappointment of life in the marketplace. So that's changed a little bit, and that makes me uneasy. And some of the groups seem to be also going backwards with a sort of a split, a sort of an implied evangelical or whatever language you want to use, Bible-based orientation versus sort of progressive or mainline orientation. We're again in the earlier parts of the Wave 3 movement in my life in the book, where you saw these people sitting happily together at the same table and breaking bread and finding fellowship, that these tripwires weren't coming up. So that concerns me. So for those of you who are shaping it, and maybe you've not seen it, but I want to put that out there as a flag. A few more things. Max Weber, I forgot my close parens, in his politics as vocation and his work on charisma and so forth. You remember he talked about how there's the charismatic leader and how do you build and grow things. It's Tom Nelson's what you're trying to figure out, right? You've got this massive church and five campuses, and how do you make it not be about you, yet at the same time, how do you recognize God's given you gifts and you should be leveraging them? Well, this Faith and Work movement is starting to get to an institutionalized place. There are some groups, as I said, with multi-million-dollar budgets and staff. And, well, that's okay, and that's great. But how do you stay true, thinking out of the current foundation, to the founder's vision? And how do you do that when the founder retires, passes away, or whatever it might be? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think it'll be interesting for us to observe this, what I just broadly call an institutionalization phenomenon. Because in the past, there was a certain energy and entrepreneurial spirit. These were small, active, vibrant groups. So here's another thing that's different. What I call ideas festivals, be it Aspen Institute or Davos. You know, Davos, of course, the World Economic Forum. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a standing group now that studies religion and the role of religion in the economy. Whoa, wait, what? The world's biggest capitalist people are all over asking the religion question. And they're asking, of course, through all the different traditions, as they should, because it reflects the world. So there's new spaces and places that are asking what we here call the Faith at Work movement, or faith in economics, work in economics kind of questions. Renaissance, that's a group that Karen and I have been going to, that's the one down in Charleston, the Renaissance weekends. same thing. There will be about, I'd say, 20% of the panels that go on during that Ideas Festival for 3 days over New Year's. About 20% of the panels are all having to do with religion and spirituality and fill in the blank, whatever it might be, including questions of calling and meaning and purpose and work. You wouldn't have seen that a few years ago. And many of the groups are also no longer just in their own hometown. They're playing ball internationally. They're raising funds. The CEO Forum, for example, has a chapter in China. And they're going global, sort of funded and founded in the US. But again, lay people, lay driven, lay led, they're going global. And again, we have the faith traditions are a little bit more diverse than before. Still some interesting questions in the demographics. Looking at questions of, in fact, we're accidentally kind of gotten a little bit of that conversation with Bruce and I at dinner. So how does the Black Church think about this question? And what are the manifestations of the Faith at Work movement in and around and through the Black Church? We didn't talk about this, but also the question of the prosperity gospel, where does that fit? A lot of times we kind of snicker at it, or one many people snicker at it, but there's a there underneath some of that. That if you've grown up in an environment where money was scarce and decent jobs were, you were prevented from getting them, an education or whatever, or training, you were prevented from getting them, the promise of the gospel tells you that you can have a decent financial life and human comforts. Well, that's a pretty attractive promise, and there's some legitimacy to it, certainly theological and practical legitimacy to that. So I think these are some things we need to understand a little bit more. What can we learn from the Black Church, which has been thinking about this for a long time, in many ways predating sort of the, if you will, the White Church's way of thinking about it. And the modes of expressions, I think, are changing. I used the word groups before, and I think I might have to come up with new language. Is it entities? Is it activities? Is it organizations? I don't really know what it is, but there's different ways this will manifest itself. Another cartoon here. So God separated the light from the dark. You get that, don't you? Check. So, where's the future? The ghost of Christmas future. Well, again, you'll see some repetitions because I want to put these here as the importance of these, so I've accented them. So from my Cyndi Lauper, Millennials Changes Everything, the politicization, culture wars, I'm concerned about that. It's no longer the movement driving its own agenda based on, if you will, client demand or user interest and demand. It's these exogenous influences. And I'm saying this not just because our hosts are here, that the impact of the Kern Family Foundation investments. I think that will be one of the things that will definitely feature in the book is some of you will know H.E. Butt, Howard Butt, and the amazing, of course, Mark, right? The amazing things that Howard did. Howard is one of the few groups that spanned multiple waves. He was part of Wave 2 and Wave 3. And in many ways, his organization shaped and formed a lot of the Faith at Work movement and the ministry, the Lady movement in particular, the wave or the epic that preceded where we are now. But that organization, while still vibrant and alive, is going in a very new direction. As Howard is no longer active in running it, and his son-in-law is running it, that movement is really not, that organization is not influencing the Faith at Work movement in a dynamic, active way today. They've gone in a different strategic direction. But I think in many ways the Kern Family Foundation, that people are going to later write dissertations about it, they're going to study it, they're going to write books about it and say, whoa, that was a game changer. That was a game changer. And look, the mere fact that we're all gathered here and you are going to go back to your seminaries and your institutions and your organizations and your churches, and you're going to be talking about something that many people have forgotten how to talk about, which for most folks is frankly central to your theology. Certainly anyone who comes anywhere near a Calvinist strand ought to be thinking about this as central to their theology. So this, I don't know how to sort of analyze it yet, but I'm convinced that we will someday say that the Kern Family Foundation was instrumental in shaping this next wave of the movement, because also their strategy is totally different than Howard Butt's. It's a very different strategy, and I think it's the right strategy for the times we're in right now. The impact of TIP and 4Es, as people begin to think about that, and how does that tie back to the millennials, technologies, different alternatives. And notice I'm being a little playful with their lack of diversity. A lot of Faith at Work gatherings, some of you were up at the Faith at Work Summit in Boston about a year ago. It was awfully hard to find anyone there who was a Catholic. I think there might have been one Catholic who was there. I don't know if I saw any Pentecostals there, or maybe I didn't see them, but they're there. That was a joke. Come on now.
Amen, brother.
All right, there we go. And where were the mainline people? It was a little bit cluggy. And by the way, I love a lot of those folks. A lot of them are dear, dear friends. They're doing amazingly terrific work. But there's, I am concerned that the movement isn't being attentive, particularly those who are leaders in the movement, aren't being attentive to its multiple faces and shapes and colors and theological differences. We've talked about the white, blue collar, hourly management. I think more attention needs to go there. Race, ethnicity, and various modes of expression. A few other considerations. Faith at work is being driven a lot of ways by the corporate environment. In the past, it was verboten, taboo, you didn't do it. Now it's actually coming up as a question, and it's often under the rubric of diversity and inclusion. And people are saying things like, well, if the LGBT group can have their gay pride week, and if they can have use of the conference room and corporate assets and facilities, why can't we? Why can't I bring myself to work just like they could bring their whole self? So you, and a lot of companies say, well, gee, there's kind of some logic to that. If we really do believe in fact, I almost got fired once. I gave a presentation to a group of top D&I leaders from 30 different companies, all Fortune 100 companies, and they asked me to speak on religion or work. And the man who hosted me was an African-American man who had a big diamond earring in his left ear. And at the end, I could tell they were very uneasy. And a lot of those people had probably been damaged and hurt by the church over the years. And many of them were hostile to anything being smacked of Christianity or religion. And I get it. So most people around the room were either people with disabilities, or gay, or people of color, or women. And I'm walking in as this white guy talking about how great faith at work is. It's sort of almost a hostile atmosphere where they're all kinds of... But anyway, at the end, they kind of... my host said, you know, David, I'm really, really glad you brought this. It's going to force us to think about some stuff. But, you know, I don't think we're really ready for this in the corporate world. It's too emotional. It's too laden with emotional things. We don't have a language and vocabulary. So I think we just need to park this for a while. And I made one of those ill-advised comments. I said, you ever say something in a big presentation, you want to like pull it back? I said, let's call him John. I said, John, you know, that's a really interesting comment, and I appreciate its difficulty. But, you know, if someone had said that to you 30 years ago, you wouldn't have had this job today. So I opened up the whole race question. Like, wow. But you get hurt. And afterwards, he's really gracious. He took me aside and said, you know, I'm really glad you said that. Because he said, you nailed it. You're right. I'm being hypocritical. That some of the very acceptance I wanted, I should be recognized that other people might want because of their faith. And I got this really long, and then of course it turns out that he had been really hurt by the church, being a gay black man, and then went through a lot of really difficult things. So his pain was real, and it was shadowing and impacting his view of a healthy view of faith, and a healthy view of faith at work. That's out there. But this D&I is probably one of the ways it'll come into the corporate world. So as you're thinking of programs and initiatives and teachings, think maybe some people view that negatively, but that's an entry route for the corporate world. As if I need to say this with anyone affiliated to the Kern Foundation, we need to not just think about work, faith and work, but economics, the structure in which we are doing our work, and the model, how economics works and how that matters. It's not scary. We don't have to all become an economist to figure it out. There's some high-level principles that any person of any professional thing can figure out. Internationalism, this is no longer just playing in our backyard. Just as the corporate world is global, so too the faith at work movement is. In fact, Greg and I were having a little conversation earlier. I think one of the biggest carriers of the gospel in the past 30 years has not been foreign missionaries, God bless them, but it's been corporate executives, expats traveling on trains and planes into countries where Christianity was expressly forbidden, and be it Muslim countries or be it China, for two big examples, and back in the day, the Soviet Union, and they're carrying the gospel. It's extraordinary stories. I can tell you about that. So in the academic world, another challenge for us is the silo problem, silos. So where does faith at work fit? Well, frankly, it should fit everywhere, just like quality should fit everybody's job. But sometimes it helps to have an expert in it or someone who's specifically trained. Do you do that through having a center? Well, that's one strategy. As we know, different seminaries or a very few seminaries have experimented with centers. Others are thinking of, do you have a faculty person? But what guild do they go in? And frankly, the tenure system discourages people specializing in this area. Most of the people I've seen who go into it do it after they get tenure. Then they can do what they really want to do, but they've got to, as it were, write for their committee and write for the guild before they can write for their heart. I take a lot of hope in the secular academy, of all strange things, that they're really all over this question. I think we can take some things out of their playbook for those of you who are trying to change the theological academy. There are a lot of non-seminary academic centers going on at Concordia College. There's the Lorenzen Center for Faith and Work in Minnesota. There's the Tyson Center for Faith and Work at University of Arkansas at the Walton School of Business. There's ours at Princeton University. There's now over a dozen centers, robust academic centers that have emerged in the secular world, talking about faith and work. And some are especially Christian related, and others like ours are looking at the Abrahamic traditions. So here's let me leave you with a couple risks. There's a little bit of, there's a risk of narcissism in this movement. And by that I mean just trying to think of me, myself, and I, and self-actualization, and how do I be happy. That's not really what Christ called us to do. Now, I'm telling you my theology here, and maybe you have a different theology, but as we were mentioning earlier, the callings can sometimes be painful and challenging and take the wind out of our sails from time to time. So I think we make a mistake if we try to dress this movie up and let this movement and have it become one of narcissism. It's really about serving others. Greg mentioned that I run this thing called the Avodah Institute. It's what I do my consulting work through, the branding of it. And the word Avodah, you might remember some of the Hebrew scholars in the room, is still a word in modern Hebrew, but in biblical Hebrew, and you'll see it throughout the Old Testament, it means three different things. Do you remember what it is? Sometimes the word, the root for Avodah, means work, like working a field, labor. Other times it means worship, as in worshiping Yahweh, the King of Kings. And sometimes the word Avodah means service. As for me and my house, we will Avodah the Lord. So one word, powerful word, means work, worship, and service. So this connecting the vertical and the horizontal of our life. That, I think, can be a good corrective to the narcissism hints I see in different places. And there's a risk of elitism. When I'm off at some of the senior leadership kind of events or CEO events, I kind of sometimes cringe in the places I am. And yet, that's also their norm, and that's their world. So you got to go where someone is. So there's pluses and minuses, but I urge us to be just a little bit careful on that. So finally, let's not lose our sense of humor. I'm going to wrap this up here with, this is where I get my shoes shined when I'm in Penn Station in New York City. We're not God, but we do save souls, so we'll shoe repair humor for New York. And I want to, and two of my favorite church pictures. Do you recognize this one, Tom? This is the Are You Awake Tom Nelson slide. So, and it's my favorite picture, not because I'm in it, that's the embarrassing part. But Tom, what was it, 2008-ish, somewhere in there, he had his church, for you don't know, it's a mega church, massive big church, he sees thousands of people, it's a big old hall. And at the front, he took any hint of sort of ecclesial trappings and religiosity, the baptismal font, everything, all that stuff disappeared, the pulpit disappeared, and he put up there a cubicle, a workplace cubicle, and he preached from that for four Sundays in a row. And one Sunday was about dedicated to each of the four E's, and then the fifth Sunday he graciously invited me out and a few others, and we had a panel and talked about sort of the integration of the four E's into how to think about faith and work at a macro level. So that's, I just love that image of a workplace cubicle in a sanctuary in place of the pulpit. And here's my other favorite church picture. This is in Bonn, Germany. As you're leaving the church, the sign over the door says, Servant's Entrance. Servant's Entrance. So with that, I thank you all. And I know it's late. I'm happy to do questions, or we could just call a wrap. But thank you, everybody. Yeah, well, just right. Someone raise your hand and we'll jump in. Yeah, thanks, Josh.
Of those 450 faith and work groups that you looked at, how many, if any, had any tie to a seminary like Mark's or Greg's now? And in broad brushstrokes, what do you know about the budgets of those?
Ties to seminary, I don't know the exact number, but very few, very few. It would be the exception, not the norm. Most are entrepreneurial outfits where someone has started up or a group of people in the community. And then the budgets vary. There are based on what they do with full-time staff. The minute you make the decision to hire an executive director, then all of a sudden you go down that path. Some have staffs of dozens, literally dozens, and you can imagine the budgets. Then, which begs the question, where does the money come from? It's not usually from foundation grants. It's from member donations or high net worth individuals who bankroll it. And I can give you, we could break some out separately and talk offline if you want, but it's really interesting to see. But a lot of the energy comes from fairly low budget operations. Yeah.
Well, you say you think there's been more faith expansion, I can't remember your words, through business executives than through missionaries.
Yeah.
Is that a personal sort of experiential observation? Do you have any data for that?
Essentially saying, prove it, pal.
Basically.
I'm with you on that. And actually, let me retract the statement and say it differently, because I said it provocatively, and I meant it to be provocative. But I cannot prove that. I don't have empirical evidence for it. But what I can say with confidence is that it's when the average citizen, I'm conjecturing, the average citizen thinks of missionary work and bringing the gospel to other places. Most people probably think of missionaries, and many churches, in fact, underwrite and pray for those men and women who go do that extraordinary work. And I guess I just want to add to the narrative that there are men and women who are extraordinarily competent at their job. The guy who ran Boeing China is a Christian, and the things he did in China because of his Christianness are extraordinary. The guy who ran Coca-Cola China was a Christian. The guy who ran GlaxoSmithKline, the pharmaceutical, and story after story. Bill Pollard, and he's written about it in his books, and he was running Service Master, of how he took that, what John Tyson is doing at Tyson Foods. So I guess want to note that there's another face of the missionary, and a lot of these expats and international executives wouldn't consider themselves a missionary, but the reality is they're opening up conversations in the halls of power and changing, moving the needle in a lot of ways. So I appreciate your corrective. I was a bit exuberant in my comment, but I do want to name them as category.
It's not even as much of a corrective as I'm excited about the possibilities of it.
Yeah.
But I am curious whether there is any data on that.
Yeah, I was mentioning to Greg actually when we were having coffee earlier today. There's a Dutch scholar and I were going to write a paper on that because she lives in China, and we were going to write a paper on expats, Christian expats who were essentially bringing the gospel, but they're doing their hard job, so it wasn't one of these wink nod kind of things. I'm here as an English teacher, but really you're evangelizing. And these people were executives, and we're going to write a book on that. We each had story after story we could tell. But we finally decided not to for two reasons. We can't leak it, that could hurt them. So then we said, we'll just anonymize the names and do it that way, like a case study. But then we just felt, actually, maybe we should just let that be quiet, because it might backfire at a macro level and the countries might start pushing back on it. But it's extraordinary. And I, even in my own modest ways, I travel around the world and do the work that I do. When I was in South Africa, when I was in Rio, when I was in Moscow, the conversations, it just takes one glass of wine, you're there, or coffee. Way back to it.
One observation about the increased politicization or the cultural war thing, there's an old quote, and I can't remember how it goes, but you may not be interested in the war, but the war's interested in you. And today, we may not be interested in the culture wars, but the culture wars are interested in us. I don't think of the student groups at Vanderbilt who were just minding their business, and then some gay guy fell affronted because he couldn't be president of the Christian Legal Society, and he raises his hand the next thing. So I think it's a different day, and it's not just that we've become snippier and more snarky and stuff, and we do in some cases, but it's coming after us, and it's all in us. So the culture war has come to us.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right, it's sort of this exogenous thing where we're kind of, those in this movement are just trying to mind their own business and do their thing, and some of the issues get forced upon. That's an interesting point, yeah. And then you have to start, do we defend, and if so, how, or whatever. That's very interesting, yeah. Yeah.
Related to that, because you mentioned students' decisions, do you have any insight on what's going to happen with the Little Sisters of the Poor decision? Because, that is going to hugely affect faith at work.
I I don't know. But you're right, the ramifications of some of these, and these weren't going on 10 years ago. The right. Supreme Court wasn't really impacting it. It was well protected by Title VII, and that's where all the action was with the EUC. Yeah, it's going to
yeah, apparently the EUC is actually about the Western world. And your sample, the former language is pulled from the United States. And there were parallel studies about faith and work happening anywhere else.
Yeah, so there's not yet been a sort of robust, rigorous, scholarly study to my knowledge. But that said, there have been some papers written in fact, one of Bob Whitno's PhD students and one of my students, she wants to write a paper. She's Chinese American about what she calls it in China, they call Christian bosses and how they're doing things differently than others. We know the same thing is going on throughout Latin America and Africa. There are lots of places where there's a lot of vibrance in the faith and work movement. And in many ways, and we're actually going to talk about this, the Pentecostal movement, which is one that not everyone necessarily in kind of mainline Christian thinks about, but that's sort of a central part. Work is a central part of their theology and their promise, the theological promise. So there's isolated papers that are going on, but there hasn't been a... It's a very difficult thing to do, but sort of a global survey. In my work, I'm trying to give pointers to say this isn't just a Western U.S. thing of Americans thinking about this. It's a global human phenomena, a global human phenomena. It's going on, believe it or not, the U.K. is very active. One of the biggest centers, Mark Green, some of you know him, at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, John Stott's one of his progeny. By the way, one of my great joys in life is when we lived in London for 8 years, we were members of All Souls Church, and when John Stott was still the pastor, as rector emeritus, and we were assigned to a small group fellowship. Can you imagine that? So for 5 years, I literally sat at the feet of John Stott and soaked up every word I could. That's when I was a banker, even. Yeah.
On the international question, I wonder if that's on the oriented, etc. It's a different structure. I've interviewed people who work in seminaries internationally. We talk about how the curriculum is structured differently because the pastors have to have mixed skills in order to survive, etc. Yeah. So I'm not sure the faith at work thing works the same way in that context.
Mm-hmm. That's an important point because even within our changing context here, I still struggle with the vocabulary myself. Is faith at work the right term? Well, it should be faith and work. Should be in the Business Academy, they call it spirituality at work. The word faith sounds too Christian to them. But I've road tested the word faith with my Jewish friends and others, and it seems to be a good umbrella term. But I think it's an interesting point that the way this will look in different contexts will be a reflection of the variables in that country, in that history. I just want another in the same table, maybe not. Oh, here we are.
One more.
I'm just not saying who I'm supposed to be seeing. Was there another hand or maybe not? Well, it's a good time.
Yeah, we can wrap up. I, however, need to flagrantly abuse my position as chair to ask you a final question. When I saw in your presentation that you rated 450 groups and none of them was strong in all four areas, I suddenly knew what my new goal for the Oikonomia would be. And I'm gonna throw caution to the wind and ask you: did you evaluate the Oikonomia Network? And if so, do you happen to remember what were our strengths and what are our growth needs? If you want to plead that you forget off the top of your head, that's
fine. Please forget. No, it's very easy to honestly forget. I'll have to check and come back. It's a great question.
I was going to follow up with you on that because I want to know where we can grow.
Yeah, and the postdoc who was focusing on that part of the research, I was really surprised when he told me that because I thought there would be some. But I know you're in the group, so I'll figure out why.
It shows how much need there is for theological depth and an integration of many different concerns.
Yeah.
David, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
All right. breakfast will be available starting at 7. At 8 o'clock, we are going to move to the meeting space and start, so please be here in time to have your breakfast by 8. And we will see you then. God bless. I'm